Hello, listeners. I'm your host, Martin Kessler, and I have eels down my leg. Joining me today is Alistair Pitts, and we're not podcasters, we are multi-millionaires.
Yes, we are, and we demand the finest wines available to humanity, and we want them here, and we want them now.
And, of course, that's because we're here to discuss Whitnail and I. I keep saying Whitnail, I got to say Whitnail.
Yeah.
It's tricky. Yeah. It's probably one of the most beloved comedies, I think, that I know of. Maybe not as popular as some, but I think the people who love it really, really love it, right?
Yeah, I think in this country, its popularity, like, it did okay on release. I mean, enough that Robinson could do another film fairly soon after, but I think it really, like, burgeoned in its popularity throughout the 90s. Like, you got to the point that Chris Evans, who British listeners will know, but listeners elsewhere, he still is a very famous, primarily radio presenter, but he was at the height of his fame and notoriety or whatever in the 90s and paid stupid amounts. And he bought Withnail's coat from the movie and then apparently wrecked it. So that was the sort of like level of cachet, I guess, of the film, was that this cool radio DJ was willing to pay lots of money for this coat, and the fact that the coat from the film was worth a lot of money rather than just being like, yeah, fine, it's a coat, you know?
Right.
But I think, like, yeah, nowadays it's perhaps not as popular. I mean, I'd have to talk to more people about, like, 10 years younger than me. I'm in my early 30s, I think.
Mm.
Like, people my age who went to uni pretty much was like essential viewing if you hadn't seen it. And I think even more so for people like 5-10 years older than me as well.
Right.
Yeah. It has a reputation as being a very student-y film. Can't imagine why.
Yeah, I think I saw this maybe when I was still in high school, even. Like, I think probably mid-2000s I saw it for the first time, actually. Partly because of the I didn't get the Criterion DVD, but I knew it was on Criterion, so I bought it just based on that. The sort of cheapy DVD instead. And I think really the only thing that I sort of recognized initially was just the Ralph Steadman artwork. That's kind of what drew me to want to see the film initially, which I think I didn't even realize it was a comedy the first time I saw it, because it doesn't strike that tone that most comedies do. And it's sort of, you know, the first couple scenes I was sort of thinking, like, what am I watching exactly, trying to figure it out. And then I think by the time Ralph Brown shows up playing that character, I was, this is a comedy. Especially because I think he plays the same character in Wayne's World 2. Or maybe not exactly the same character, but it's the same performance.
Oh, come on. Yeah, essentially, either Mike Myers, whoever directed the film, essentially went to Ralph Brown, look, the thing that you did in Withnail, just do that.
Right.
You know, and if anything, just go a bit more extreme. Except you can't really talk too much about drugs because we're going for PG-13, I guess.
Exactly. He does talk about beating somebody to death with their own shoes, worse than anything he says in Whitnail and I, but
true, but censorship being working the way that it does, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yes, it's that deadpan delivery. I had to beat him to death with his own shoes. okay, but, I need to stop quoting, because otherwise it will just be the whole thing.
Well, I mean, we can talk about that, because I think a lot of conversations about Whitnail and I do descend into quoting the film. And I know so many fans who, that's what they do. They just quote it kind of ad nauseum. And it's interesting because a lot of the lines aren't particularly funny just on their own. I think it's the delivery, it's the performance that sort of makes a lot of those lines.
Not
to say that they're not funny, but it's the particular way that they're spoken. You know, if you just kind of look at it on the page, I think it can be difficult to realize why it would be funny. I know Bruce Robinson talked a little bit about having one of his producers, trying to get him to make some significant changes because, no, like, this movie's not going to be funny. And Bruce Robinson had to just sort of tell him, trust me. And he nearly quit the film, I think, on the first couple days.
Yeah, I think it was quite a troubled production. And I think I read, it was about a year ago, slightly longer, Richard E. Grant's biography that I think he, autobiography that he wrote, I guess, mid-90s. And he, there was, a, you know, obviously a whole chapter of With Nell and I, because it was his breakout role. And I think I remember him saying, basically, like, you know, the cast and the crew at one point were like, is this the end of the film? Is this just going to collapse around us? Because, because Robinson was fighting with the producers over various bits and pieces. And I think he was, you know, he'd been out of work for a long time. And, you know, it was like, oh, finally, when I get a break and some work and it's all, you know, collapsing around my ears. It didn't seem like it was a production that looked like it was just going to be a massive success, you know, that it, you know, ultimately became, I guess, sort of sleeper hit.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it is hard to convince people why the film should work. You know, if you just tell somebody the premise, oh, it's about these two out of work actors who drink a lot and go on a holiday by mistake, and then they come back and they're like, you know, that's basically all it is. There's not really that much of a hook.
I've tried to get my wife to watch this film quite a few times and I've just given up because she's watched, like, I think the first 10-15 minutes a few times, and she's just like, no, can't be doing with this. This is just too grim. And like you say, it isn't particularly clear that it's a comedy straight away. And I think even Bruce Robinson described it as a comedy without any jokes, which is
right. A
slight hyperbole with that.
There's a few things that could count as jokes proper. One of them would be the device to put urine in for the alcohol test or drug test
visual
that the
gags,
police do. Like
that's
a joke. That's a gag.
There's another nice one where Withnail is complaining about his family not supporting his career decision, and they hate the fact that he's on the stage, and the I character says, well, they must be very pleased with your career, you know, with a strong I've totally butchered that telling of the joke, but essentially he's strongly implying that, well, it's not like you're ever on the stage, so it probably doesn't bother them too much.
Right. But it's the kind of dialogue you sometimes have in real life. I mean, the performances are very big, but it's not an over-the-top film. You know, I sort of, it reminds me of actors I've worked with and know, and people in the arts I know who can be big personalities and sometimes act in ways that are a little bit over-the-top that you can find very funny, but you know, that's sort of just how they are. And even some of the self-destructive behavior, I mean, you know, the not in specific, but there are things about these characters that remind me very, very much of people I know in my own life or have known. Maybe when I was a little bit younger, I kind of thought that, you know, the two main characters, Whitnell and I, are cool. And, you know, maybe when you're a teenager, you're the person who wants to buy the jacket and wear it, you know, and be a little bit like these characters. And then I found just the older I get, the more distance I have from them. And like, even to the point where I don't want to call them pathetic, but
I think there's a validity to that. I don't think you have to necessarily get fully behind the use of that word, but
right.
Yeah, you are onto something.
At the very end, at least, the I character, who's sort of based on Bruce Robinson himself, and I know he said that the Whitnail character is based very closely on somebody he knew, when they kind of go their separate ways, it does make me think of how, you know, there are people that are fun to be around and you have fun, and then if you stick around too long, you sort of realize that they're always like that and they're not necessarily always happy. And you know, you're going, you know when to stop having that fun and you go and do work and he gets a job. And the Whitnail character, you kind of get the impression that he's just going to stay in that accidental holiday mold for, you know, maybe ever. He's not going to get work acting, even though clearly from the last scene he's a talented actor.
Yeah.
What a piece of work is a man. How noble in reason, how infinite in faculties, how like an angel in apprehension, how like a god. The beauty of the world, pagan of animals. Yet to me, what is this quintessence of dust?
You know, maybe I think it even implies in the film that he's maybe more talented an actor than the main character is.
Quite possibly,
you know,
yeah.
But he's not going to have a career.
No.
Maybe I'm just thinking that, like, you know, Richard E. Grant's character, like, you know, he does have maybe a little bit more charisma than the Paul McGann character. I think it's deliberate.
Yeah.
I don't think it's an accident. I think, you know, you're meant to see why he wants to hang around with Whitnell and why, you know, Whitnell, like, he does have this little almost sociopathic streak in him when he's ready to sell him out or, you know.
Oh, totally. Like, one of the big things is just the sheer cowardice of Whitnell. I've found it really difficult to pin down, like, why I feel at all sympathetic to him at the end when things turn out that way, because he has just been a nasty little piece of work the whole time.
Yes.
Like, you have the whole incident in the bar where he makes a not particularly great situation so much worse with his bravado. I love that business about going, whatever problem you have with my acquaintance. It's just breathtaking. It's like, oh, where's your loyalty, Whitnell? The I character is very irresponsible as well, but of the two, he's the sensible one.
Yes.
And when they're in the they've already gone to the Lake District, he's sort of trying to come up with practical solutions, even if they are quite earnest and silly. Like, I love the thing where he says about, let's split into two fact-finding groups. It's like, groups? There are only two of you. A lot of the humour, I think, comes from the fact that neither of them think that this is funny at all.
Right.
And just kind of see that they're being a bit ridiculous.
Exactly.
Lack of perspective, I guess.
Bruce Robinson said that the lack of self-awareness is partly what makes them funny.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
I think he even said that on set, if he found that people were laughing, he had to do another take because he wanted the take where people didn't laugh.
There's not a whole lot of, like, bonhomie between the two of them. They're kind of, like, despite the fact that they are very much not a couple, they do kind of bicker like the stereotypical people who've been in a relationship and lived in close proximity for a long, long time. You know, you can see that they get on each other's nerves.
For sure. I mean, when Uncle Monty, the character, comes in and thinks that they are a couple, like, it's not much of a stretch
to
believe that, you know.
Yeah, especially when somebody that, for whatever reason, you're inclined to trust, you know, tells you that straight. And I don't know how well Monty and Whitnell know each other. I mean, obviously they're related, but you don't know how much time they've spent with each other because there's quite an age difference. You know, whether Monty, and Monty's not exactly particularly self-aware either, you know, how that he doesn't know not to trust Whitnell, seemingly.
Right.
Whereas you'd feel like if you'd spent a lot of time with Whitnell, you'd know not to trust him.
Right. I almost wonder if the Uncle Monty character kind of lets Whitnell get away with more because he's sort of lonely and just likes the attention.
I always think
it's funny when he just shows up at the cabin. He just wants to be part of that group, and you can kind of tell that he wants to be, like, with the young guys.
Yeah.
I mean, there's aspects of the character that are, you know, a little predatory.
A little?
more than a little predatory when he's getting close with the I character. And I think the film is still sympathetic towards him, more so than the main characters are. I think,
oh, definitely.
You know, you can feel sympathy
for
the Uncle Monty character because you can tell that he's just lonely. He's a really lonely guy.
Yeah, and I mean, I looked it up because I didn't have this fact just, like, to hand, but I think gay sex was only legalized in Britain like 1967,
right?
Which is 2 years before this was set. So just growing up, you know, if he ever got caught, he could be prosecuted and put in prison. So that, you know, just having to go through that in your life.
Yeah, it's interesting too. Like, I know Bruce Robinson said there was also pressure to make the character of Uncle Monty very flamboyant, very sort of stereotypically gay.
Yes.
And, you know, the producers thought, like, that's what'll make the character funny. And I know Bruce Robinson really resisted that and tried to, you know, treat him like a real
person.
Real person. Yeah.
Thank goodness. Because, I mean, you can't say he's not flamboyant, but he's not flamboyant in the... You know, if you say, like, okay, imagine a really terrible portrayal of a gay character. He isn't that, even though there's a certain amount of overlap.
Right.
But it isn't that, yeah, you know.
He's flamboyant in the way that, you know, some people are when you meet them,
yeah.
Really. I like all his innuendos when he's talking about how the carrot has mystery.
Yes, yeah. It's you a know, really
those are
good
so
performance.
Great.
It's a
great performance. Richard Griffiths.
Yes,
He's one of those, like, that guy actors. Like, I think he was in the Harry Potter films, right?
And, yeah, actually, while we're talking about Harry Potter actors, which is everyone... Apparently, Kenneth Branagh auditioned for the Withnail character.
Yeah,
how terrible would that be?
I think that wouldn't have worked. Exactly.
No,
yeah.
It would not have worked. It's hard to say why, because Branagh obviously is very good in most things that he's in, but I think sometimes just the physicality of an actor is important to certain parts. I think in some roles, it's more just how it's written, but I think just the way Richard E. Grant looks, because he's not conventionally super handsome.
He's so gangly. Like, he looks like if somebody, I think again of the Ralph Steadman drawings, he has that kind of elongated, gangly, sort of exaggerated physique, which helps with the performance. I think that's a big part of it, actually.
Yeah, and he looks sort of aristocratic, or how you would imagine.
I think he said, like, he doesn't drink at all.
No.
You know, so for the film that they, I think Bruce Robbins said he had to get him, like, drunk once just to show him what it was like. But it's, like, the best drunk acting I've ever seen, I think, in a film. Because it's somebody trying to act grounded and not ridiculous,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, because one of the funny things about the way he acts is the character doesn't realize how drunk he is and just tries to kind of function regardless. He's, like, the whole business of when he gets stopped by the police.
Right.
And he's just like...
he doesn't have a driver's license, even.
It's just like...
Yeah.
Withnail, no one is buying this. I've only had a couple of
ales. He's just making the situation worse because he won't fess up to it.
And that's definitely an example of Chekhov's urine emitting contraption.
Right.
I love how they foreshadow that, and it's just like, yeah, you know that's gonna come off. And you know it's not gonna work in the intended way.
No. No, it doesn't. There are a lot of setups and payoffs. I think,
yeah,
that's one thing that comes through in the writing. It's again, like you said, not obvious jokes, but, you know, if a character's introduced, they have to come back at a certain point. There's a lot of little through lines throughout the film.
I was thinking about this, and there are three distinct sections in that you've got the sort of pre, you know, quote-unquote holiday setup, then you've got the holiday, and then you've got returning to London. So, and then,
right,
not exactly equal length, but they're similar.
It's three-act structure where it's like, you know, a little bit shorter first act, and then long second act, and then shortest
sort of
third
up.
Act to tie it up. Yeah, no, it is. I mean, it's a great screenplay.
Oh, certainly, certainly. I mean, I think that's one of in, like, the sort of preparatory email you sent over, you said about, you know, watching other films that he's done and Robinson isn't that prolific, and I literally until last night hadn't seen anything else he'd done. So I went and watched Jennifer A, and one of the big differences was there wasn't the sort of, well, there wasn't much anyway of the very distinctive way of characters talking.
Right.
There's the unusual and memorable turn of phrase, which is, I mean, we've sort of covered this a bit already, but just it's not particularly because they're funny, but they are striking turns of phrases. They avoid cliche quite a lot. It's just, yeah, it's just memorable. And I'm not going to quote a whole bunch of it, but it's like, I'm just looking at my notes just to pick off a random example. Like there's the bit where they have to kill the chicken, and Withnail says, "How can we make it die?" rather than "How do we kill it?"
Yeah. You know,
it would be much more conventional to say,
"That's my favorite line in the movie." Yeah, but it, like, at the same time, it does sort of highlight the fact that they're from the city, they're not country people, and just the awkwardness of that use of phrase,
yeah,
just shows how unfamiliar they are with the idea of killing a chicken.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, never done it myself, and I definitely feel for the characters in that moment, because I would struggle to have to kill something I was going to eat with my bare sure. with my bare hands. But I love how insistent they are that they're not from London.
Yes,
it's like, yes, you are. And they know it. And there's, I looked it up this time because Marwood/I makes some reference about him expecting the people from around there to be very different, because they weren't the way that they were in the H.G. Bates novel, and I wasn't familiar with Bates, so I just looked that up. And as far as I can tell, those novels are all set in a very different rural part of England. I mean,
sure,
it just sort of demonstrates his ignorance, just lumping people from the far north of England. You're practically, you're getting towards being in Scotland at that point when you're in the Lake District. I mean, not quite, but yeah, it's not Kent or Bedfordshire or any of the places that novel's set. So those novels are set. So it's, yeah.
It's interesting. The piece you wrote that you sent me, you described it as essentially situational comedy.
Yeah.
But it's not, you know, when you say situational comedy, Withnail and Ice probably not
no.
comes to mind.
You think of Friends or even like, for a weirder but still very popular example, Seinfeld. Yes.
Right.
Although this is probably closer to being Seinfeld than...
Yeah, I was just about to say, I mean, people call Seinfeld a show about nothing, you know. There's a lot of non-jokes in Seinfeld that are very funny, and like in that way it has some similarity. Mm. You know, there's no little like music cue or laugh track, which,
yeah,
you know, thank God. But,
oh, how awful would this be with the slap bass?
I want to see somebody do a fan edit where there's just like weird little sound cues in between the scenes, because there are these quiet moments throughout the film. It's not constantly being hilarious. It kind of knows when to take a little break. And I like just some of the scenes where I is walking through the country and looks out, and it's actually quite beautiful.
Yeah, I wanted to mention that scene. It's lovely. It's very short. Yeah. And you just see some of the gorgeous landscape. One of the things that appealed to me, because I spent, I think, 3 or 4 summers in a row in my mid-teens going up to the Lake District with my parents. And the thing about the Lake District, if you've not been, is it's gorgeous, incredibly beautiful when it's not raining.
Right.
Which is what is happening a lot of the time. I also went to uni up in Lancaster, which is just south of there. And northwest England, it's very, very, very rainy. I mean, my recollections of my first term at university, sorry, I'm sounding like Uncle Monty, Oxford, or in my case, Lancaster. My recollections, I'm sure this isn't actually true, but my recollection is that it rained every single day of my first term. And that this film gets that across. Like, and even in that scene, you just have this little bit of sunshine and him enjoying the countryside and just walking through it, and then talking to the grumpy old lady, and then it's raining again.
Right. Well, it's one of the grayest films I think I've ever seen, partly like in the choice of color palettes, you know, those big gray coats, but like just the countryside when it's sort of rainy and the skies are gray, it's so,
the sky is beginning to bruise. Sorry, I'm doing it, and I said, like, I wouldn't.
I it's so hard not to. I know, I'm resisting temptation myself.
Non-fans are going to just be like, with Neil and I are just going to be like, what are they talking about? Go away and watch the film. It's good.
It's great. But, like, comedies aren't usually shot this way. They don't look dreary.
Dreary, you know, is not a particularly comedic adjective. No.
No, you know, there's films that are very, very funny, but the way they're shot, it's so flat, even lighting, kind of colorful, you know, like that's the sort of standard. You know, this is a moody film, which is unusual.
Melancholic.
I completely agree. I think, especially by the time you get to that last scene, you sort of let the melancholy come through to,
like,
the surface.
Wash over you in waves like the rain,
exactly.
But it does kind of earn it, because there's been rain throughout the film. It's not like, okay, we need to go sad now. Here's some rain.
Right.
You know, because that's such a cheap device.
Yeah.
Which is why it gets used all the time. But
if it was shot like a standard comedy, and then you got to that last scene and it got sort of serious and rainy, like, you couldn't buy it.
It would be like, I think the fact get that lost, director. This sucks that you're trying to make us care now.
Sure. You know, and I think it's because you sort of feel it brewing the whole time that it works, that last scene.
Yeah.
And thinking about where the characters are going to end up, you almost feel like maybe that's the last time they're going to see each other.
Probably, yeah. The trajectory is not good. You know, if he doesn't make a serious change or somebody doesn't intervene in his life, he's not going to last very long. I thought it was interesting, the use of Hendrix in the film, because it's brilliant, but the fact that, I actually got this wrong, I thought that Hendrix died in 69, so, like, literally a week or so before this film happens in the film's timeline. It turns out it's actually the following year, but still, I think if you know that about Hendrix and the whole sort of doomed 60s kind of, like, rock star lifestyle, which essentially is what they're doing on a very limited budget, you kind of go,
yes,
yeah, all very fun at the time, although the film does a good job of showing it not being particularly glamorous.
Right.
You can only live that way for, you know, a certain amount of time before it catches up with you. Sorry, I'm sounding really preachy, but it is interesting when there's so much said about how glamorous the 60s was, but this really doesn't paint it that way. And I think the fact that it's coming from somebody who, this by the sounds of things, did have that kind of a lifestyle means that it's, that you take it more seriously. It's not just somebody going, well, I don't know anything about that, but I know it's bad. It's like, okay, I'll actually take your word for it, because you actually did that.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, that's very interesting how it creates a microcosm for that, of the period, you know, because it doesn't feel like a 60s film in any obvious way.
No, because we're used to that being kind of like Groovy Baby type.
Sure. Yeah, but even like we said, the way it's shot, the way it's, you know, that there's not really too many significant markers of the period. Even in their apartment, they have like silent film stars up everywhere because they're actors. So, you know, they have Louis Brooks and...
I didn't notice that, but I'm less well-versed okay. in that era. But that's a huge, huge understatement. But anyway.
Yeah, I think there's like Harold Lloyd hanging from the watchtower, stuff like that. You know, like it's... I think I know actors where if I walked into their apartments, it would look exactly the same today.
Yeah.
So, you know, there are things that feel sort of timeless about it, you know, and the fact that it's in the countryside, like, it doesn't feel like it's like this is the 60s in a very in your face way, but at the same time, like you said, it does capture that milieu of the period,
the bohemian kind of rock and roll. They're not musicians, they're actors, but it, you know, there's a sort of certain continuum between the two and like association. But there's like with the aesthetics, I'd say timeless, but also kind of crumbling and falling apart. Like, like in Monty's old cottage, it's, you know, clearly not very well kept up, but it has like old portraits of the monarchy that have just been on there for a long time. Like, I want to say it's probably George V's up there.
Right.
And, And it's, yeah.
But yeah, it looks like it's been like untouched since like, you know, 40s.
Oh,
it,
yeah.
And they mentioned he doesn't go very often, so it's this sort of dusty old place that...
And then you have like the... I think he's... I want to call him the major in the first pub that they go to, who's, you know, talking about the being the armed forces. And that, that's very much a Britain that was basically going away at that point. That sort of like Britain is this mighty
empire
that bestrides the globe, you know. Not that that's a good thing, but just be clear on that. As a British person, you do feel like you have to make sure that people know, I don't want that back.
Right, but like I can understand why somebody in the 1960s would feel a little bit nostalgic, especially when, you know, it feels like the good days, the best days are behind you, like,
well,
for a British citizen, maybe not for other people in the world.
Well,
but...
and also, as you know, somebody who knows a little bit about British social history, the 60s, I think, were quite a good decade, but the 70s were super bleak and just, you know, strike ridden and, you know, put it
inflation,
the 3-day week, I mean, to the point that just to wear my politics on my sleeve a bit here, that Margaret Thatcher seemed like a good idea. Things have to be pretty bad when somebody like that is seen as like, you know, a refreshing wind of change, you know.
Right.
Ugh. Sorry, I'm probably alienating some listeners there, but hey, I'm just going to be...
No, like,
just allow me a little
saying.
Bit of obnoxious Withnalian something pronouncements.
Well, like, this is a Thatcher period film, right?
It is, yeah, it's 87, but it's the least 80s, you know, in terms of films that were made in the 80s, I wouldn't be able to tell if I didn't know, you know?
Right.
That's one of the things that's really nice about it, because... I recently watched Dirty Dancing for the first time. I think it was about a month ago. And it's supposed to be set in the early 60s. And some of the period detail is, as far as I'm aware, quite good. But then there are some very, very heavy, this was made in the 80s, wasn't it, moments.
Right.
Particularly like with musical choices and haircuts. sure. But yeah, this doesn't have any of that.
Yeah, again, it's sort of timeless in that way.
But I wanted to... talk a little bit about the nostalgia point that you raised, because that's definitely a big theme of the film, because it's not just the older characters and the older, like, more traditional ish obviously the major or you know, the pub landlord is one guy, and obviously Uncle Monty is not that traditional in, you know, quote unquote, in some ways, but he's also very establishment in others, like the fact that he comes from money, as, you know, the Withnail family apparently does. But Danny, he has this, like, not quite a soliloquy, but he's talking about how awful it is that the 60s are basically now over. I mean, I like the fact it's 91 days from the end of the, you know, the greatest decade in the history of humanity, or whatever he says.
Right.
So that's kind of weird that you have such very different characters all just going, yeah, things aren't as good as they used to be, or are about to get not as good as they are now.
Right. I like the Danny character. It's sort of interesting because he's so on the edge of being completely burnt out.
Yeah.
I mean, he's kind of a burnout already. But...
oh, yeah. Like the bit where he takes off his sunglasses and you just see his eyes.
He's got those giant dark bags under his eyes. But you know, you feel like that's the toll of the 60s at the same time.
The
fun of it, the greatness of it, it just left people burnt out, I think, in some ways. Maybe that's what that character, if you want to say he represents anything, might represent.
Although it's kind of interesting, it doesn't seem to be taking quite the same toll on him as it seems to be physically taking its toll on Withnail himself, but there seems to be like a slightly Keith Richards indestructibility about him.
Sure.
To reference, you know, Wayne's World 2 again, indirectly.
Sure.
Which is why he cannot be killed by conventional.
Comes up a lot on this show for some reason.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I always think that with Nail, things are just going to get worse and worse for him.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think the Marwood Eye character, he probably should have bailed earlier, really. But, you know, you're just thinking, yeah, you are definitely making the right choice there.
Yeah. It's an interesting dynamic because, like you said, the Whitnail character can kind of sell out the Eye character at various points. Yeah. And, you know, can be a little bit cowardly. Like, I always think what's a very funny scene is with the bull.
Oh, my goodness.
And he jumps over the hill and he basically says, like, oh, you take care of it. Yeah. You just charge at him. Charge at the bull.
Yeah, and he's just very matter-of-fact and just sort of, like, just, you know, just, like, coaching him through it, but not... it's kind of like it's okay for you to be like that. He's not that concerned, and he's just kind of like giving this sort of like, you know, I don't see why you're so
bothered.
It's
like that, like, big brotherly advice, almost like, oh, just run at him. But,
yeah,
you know, but it becomes clear at a certain point that he needs the Eye character more than the Eye character needs him.
Definitely.
You know, even though he's somebody you might look up to, like, I think. You know, you do end up in those friendships sometimes, or relationships, where you kind of look up to the other person. You know, they seem very cool and, you know, interesting and talented. And then after a while, you sort of realize that, again, like, you don't really, that they're like an anchor that dragging you down. You don't want to be around them. They're just like a, you know, little black hole that'll suck you in at a certain point if you don't get away.
Oh, definitely. That's a good metaphor for him. Yeah. Yeah. How did you like the way the film was directed in terms of, like, the... I mean, we've talked a bit about, like, the colour palette and that side of things, but, like, the mechanics of how some of the scenes played out in terms of the cuts and that sort of thing, the editing. You can tell I'm a film admirer rather than a professional.
What always kind of surprises me is that it was Bruce Robinson's first film. And
very assured, isn't it?
I mean... What's strange, you hear the behind-the-scenes stories, and he says, you know, he told the crew when they were starting out, I don't know what I'm doing, I'm going to make mistakes, just please deal with me, basically. But
yeah,
I don't know if it's that situation where, because you don't know entirely what you're doing, you make very bold choices that maybe somebody who's a bit more experienced might be more trepidatious about making, you know, like, it feels... And I always feel a little bit bad when I say that somebody's first film is their best film.
But,
you know, but, I think,
I mean,
he
also hasn't given himself many chances to make a better film.
Right. I mean,
because he's not prolific.
Jennifer Eight's, like, a film I actually like quite a bit for, you know, especially its atmosphere and its gloominess. You know, I think something about that just rainy world appeals to me.
Yeah,
but, like, it's not as good as Whitnail and I, you know.
No.
How to Get Ahead in Advertising, it's funny, but it doesn't have that same sort of emotional anchor, I find.
Mm.
And, I mean, have you seen any of Rum Diary?
No, I haven't.
Or
no,
trailer?
No.
I mean, that, to me, that's really interesting, because he hadn't made a film for a long time.
Yeah.
I think on the Neil Jordan episode, it might have been...
It was mentioned, yeah.
It might have come up that, like, he had a very bad... Bruce Robinson had a hard time making Jennifer Eight.
Yeah, I'd read that.
To the point where he didn't want to make a film again. I was just reading recently, you know, one of the interviews for research for this episode, him saying that Jennifer Eight, you know, he had so many producers telling him what to do and what choices to make. Like, he just didn't want to do that again. And I think, like, you know, Johnny Depp kind of dug him up out of retirement to do Rum Diary. Like, in some ways, you know, it's not just the Ralph Steadman cover, but like, he kind of does, I think, in Whitnail and I, he does like Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas better than the Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas film, you know, the sort of manic bravado of it, the internal monologue.
I thought that was an interesting thematic link as well, the fact that the alcoholism is an important element in Jennifer Eight.
Fact
that seems like it's a thing that he's... I mean, as I say, that's the only other film of his I've seen, but the fact that apparently he returns to it quite a bit, so I thought that was interesting. I did have one quick comment about him being a totally inexperienced director. I guess the fact that he didn't know what he was doing technically means that he doesn't have the option of a... He doesn't have the technical knowledge to micromanage. He basically has to just trust everyone to get on and that they're professionals and can do their jobs well. I think that might be part of why it's... Why it's good.
Although sometimes I heard you could micromanage the performances, you know, if you wanted something spoke in a very specific way. Like, I kind of understand that.
Yeah, but he was an actor, so you could say that's, you know, that's more his expertise rather than, like, telling, I don't know, the sound guy, you know, where to stick the microphone, you know?
Sure. Exactly. Like, I think a lot of actors turn director. I mean, it's weird. I don't even particularly think of Bruce Robinson mostly as an actor, but I guess that's what he's done more of than anything else.
And that's how he started out.
You know, if you work with a bunch of directors, you get a sense of how to direct actors, you know, how you yourself would like to be directed, so you can kind of translate that very easily. But he's also, you know, a great writer, I think, too. So I think that skill comes in, because a lot of actors turn director, I think, in general, broadly speaking, I think have even very talented actors turn director, they have a tendency to, like, okay, the big dramatic scene is the two main characters yelling at each other. That's drama. It's yelling. Here's the scene where they cry. Like, I think, you know, even, like, John Cassavetes, who, you know, he's like a filmmaking god, you know, it's still like, oh yeah, he's still like an actor turn director when you get to the big drama of it. You know, so, like, I think the idea that so much of the tension that grows in between these two characters, you know, even though they're so close, you kind of feel the gap widening between them throughout the film, how much that's in the subtext of the film. You know, I think that shows a, you know, maybe a talent as a writer that he brought to the film that I think makes it, you know, very memorable and very moving in sort of an unexpected way that I appreciate.
Yeah. And it definitely, right from the start, you're given clues to the way that it's going. Like, the first thing you see is him looking kind of despairing and just exhausted and washed out. And then it cuts to that scene at the rather depressing, like, Greasy Spoon calf, and it's kind of like, all is not well. And he even has, like, a sort of a little voiceover about how things aren't going well, and then he sets, because I'd forgotten whose idea it was to go on the holiday, and it's actually his, and it's almost like that cliche that couples who are that are going through difficulties supposedly, like, oh, just go away, because, you know, it won't be like you'll be just taking your personalities, which are the problem, along with you.
I mean, that's a really good point, actually, because, like, they're in isolation, they can't really I think it is, because, you know, you take those characters out of their typical environment where everything's like you know, and put them in this isolated little cottage, and it really amplifies just how maybe incompatible they actually are, even though they're so comfortable with each other.
Because familiarity may breed a certain amount of contempt, but it also, when it becomes the new normal, I mean, I can understand his rationale, thinking, okay, if we go a long way from London and Danny and, you know, his purveying of rare herbs and prescribed substances, then maybe that will help. But they still have plenty of booze to get hold of, so...
Somehow, they always find a way...
By hook or by crook,
Don't mix your drinks. the lighter fluid, it's like the grossest thing I can think of. So awful. And, like, talking about, well, maybe we should get a hold of antifreeze. It's like, ugh.
It's just like, oh, for goodness sake. Yeah, and that's very early on as well. It's not like he works up to that.
No, it's right off the bat. You know, they're constantly finding booze somehow, and I don't drink, but it's like disgusting to me. Just how steady and how, like, low quality some of it is that they seem to be scrounging up. And, you know, going from that to fine wines back to
whatever they can just lay their hands on.
That sort of lack of distinction, how somebody could have, like, a very expensive whiskey or you know, whatever, and then mix it with like total trash, and how it makes like no difference to them. It's just alcohol in their system.
Yeah.
Like, again, like getting back to the alcoholism, like Bruce Robinson, I don't know if he's ever talked about it in interviews, but, you know, I'd be curious if he, you know, not to be rude, but like if he had problems with alcohol or, you know.
I want to say that's true. Yeah, I think I did read that. He does kind of also just seem like somebody who either doesn't give a damn what you think or really wants you to think that he doesn't give a damn what you think.
Right.
He has that sort of, you know, just sort of slightly gung-ho, it seems, personality, which in that regard seems to make him a bit more like Withnail than the Eye character, but, you know.
Yeah.
But he seems like an interesting guy.
Yeah. I mean, what I was going to say before, and I sort of went down a tangent, but like the Rum Diary, it makes so much sense that you would want to get Bruce Robinson to direct that. And
okay.
I think the film, it's not good. Like, something about it just doesn't work, and it's hard to pinpoint what exactly, because, like, if he was in Withnail and I mode, I think it would be a great film, maybe, but it's not, and I don't know if that's the fact that he, you know, was basically retired from directing for so many years, or if he just wasn't in that place, and he had people who wanted him to be in that place, and you can't force it.
Yeah.
Johnny Depp, like, I think Johnny Depp must be like a huge, huge Withnail and I fan, because like most of his performances from the past, I don't know, 15 years have basically just been an imitation of Richard E. Grant in Withnail and I. Like that's what he's doing, right? You know, that kind of Keith Richards-y, the sort of like, you know, that's a big part of the Jack Sparrow character.
Which was fun the first time, at least
Johnny Depp's performance of like, all his performances, I think, have gotten, like, lazier over time, but they all kind of fall back on that, oh, I just want to be, like... Like, again, I think he's maybe, like, one of the teenagers or, you know, radio hosts who just want to kind of be that character and have the jacket and doesn't realize that maybe he's not actually as cool as he might first seem, you know?
Yeah, and that's not really what the film is saying. It's not saying, get wasted all the time. It's really great.
That was Johnny Depp's takeaway from the film.
I tend to avoid alcohol when I can.
I could see why you'd think that they were cool, and I thought they were kind of cool, but I never wanted to, like, emulate that.
Exactly.
But at the same time, I could relate enough to being a young man who doesn't quite know what they want to do, or if they do know what they want to do, for whatever reason they're not able to be doing that, you know, because they do have ambitions, clearly. It's just that their pursuit of them isn't as focused as it might be, let's say. I mean, that's part of this, like, one of the big differentiators between the two characters is the Eye character. When he's got a chance of a role, it's not the best thing ever, but he gets that you can't just land the star role straight off, that you have to work up to it in most cases, whereas I is just kind of like, no, that's beneath my dignity. And, you know, he has the opportunity for something that might lead to something else, and he's just like, nope, I'm going to be a star.
Withnail wants to be a star, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And he doesn't get that that doesn't happen straight away in the vast majority of cases, and, you know.
Right. I mean, even if he's a talented actor, I think he's more in love with the idea of being an actor than he is actually putting in the work.
Doing the work.
Yeah.
That's totally fair. That's totally fair. Yes. Yeah. And it certainly suggests at the end, that final scene, that he could do it if he worked at it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could say, well, how much is he acting in that last scene? And how much does he just feel as miserable as you imagine Hamlet feels in that scene?
Yes.
But it's great work on Richard E. Grant's part.
Yeah.
He's so good in this.
He's so good. I think even though he's not the Eye character, he's kind of the focal point of the film. You know, maybe not necessarily the main character, but he's the center of it, I think.
Yeah. He's... Yeah, it's. I was going to say he steals every scene he's in. I'm not sure that's really true because the ones with Ralph Brown, right. It's Ralph Brown. But yeah, he's kind of the heartbeat of the thing, but the eye character kind of holds it together and gives it the coherence.
It's like the right decision to end the film on him. You know, I think if like the last scene was. You know, the eye character in a taxi cab thinking, like, I wonder whatever happened to Whitney. Like, I think that wouldn't be the right ending for it, you know?
No.
Even though that's sort of...
I think you're right.
How you might end up feeling, like, you know, you do come at it more from the eye character's perspective, you know? I think you identify more with him, but it's so you can look at Whitney and think about him.
And I also like that it ties back... The fact that it's Hamlet ties back in with... Monty saying, I guess about a third of the way in, when they're just before they set off on the trip, about talking about playing the Dane, and with the sort of time in a young man's life when he realized, I will never play the Dane, says, I intend to play. It's a part I intend to play, I think, is what he says, and then you get to see a little bit of that. Even though you realize you're probably never going to see him on stage doing that.
Yeah.
This is the closest you're going to get.
I mean, I always wonder, like, sometimes you see these people who are so talented, even if they find some degree of success, but they're also so self-destructive, you know?
Yeah.
It comes up so often.
In many walks of life.
Music I always associate with sometimes these very talented, self-destructive people, you know? You always think about, like, even going way back, like, you know, Mozart just being like a huge alcoholic and dying so young, you know, like that's not anything new. That's always been like that.
Well, Hendrix again, and you know, it's a very good choice that's the musician that they have. And I mean, it's good in terms of like what the image they're showing on screen of the driving. It works very well, but also having that bit of subtext. I'm probably repeating myself at this stage.
How old was Jimi Hendrix when he died?
I think he was like the rock and roll 27, the sort of rock and roll age of death.
I guess, yeah, you know, like,
27,
how old,
whatever that's with called.
Now, he says he's like in his late 20s,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, he says he's about to turn 30.
Okay. So, I don't know, like, he might not live to 30. I don't know.
Not at this rate.
Maybe I'm being a little bit too pessimistic about him, but like, for a film that's absolutely hilarious, you laugh, you know, pretty consistently through the whole way through. It does leave you with these pretty melancholic, bitter emotions at the end.
Yeah,
you know, this sort of like. Sadness of the past. it's such a strange mixture of emotions. Yeah,
a thing I noticed this time that I'd never noticed, just in terms of his attention to detail, was at one point the eye character is reading Journey's End, and I was going, oh, where do I know that title? And I looked up, and it's a book set at the end of, but not after, World War One. And my understanding is that it's kind of very doom heavy, and I thought that's an interesting little detail that you have a character reading something about doomed young men, essentially.
Huh.
It's just a little extra detail.
Great. Yeah, that's a good observation. Is there anything else you wanted to touch on or mention that we didn't cover, or?
Oh, it's the sort of, that's a dangerous question to ask because you never know whether
could go on for another hour.
Yeah, exactly. There was some nice cinematography. I think that was I really appreciated that I got to see it at a cinema, so I could appreciate that the first time around. I mean, it's not like it's not Tarkovsky or anything, but there are like it doesn't feel like it's just essentially it could have been on a tiny little TV and. That would have worked, you know? It does feel cinematic.
It does. It's very cinematic, especially, like, there's that whole stretch where they go fishing with the gun and you see... you know, when they go for the walk with Uncle Monty and there's this, like, giant log in the foreground.
Oh,
and, like,
yes.
It's such a beautiful shot.
I was just
going
to mention that. Yeah, it's so well framed. And then you just see the little three figures walking, like, along the hill line. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
It's beautiful. It's a beautiful film. There's a visual eye at work that I think shows a real talented director. You know, it's not just, you know, not just somebody who's good at working with actors and good at writing a screenplay. Like, I think, he has like a real eye that, even in his other films, you know, if can sort of pick on them, say that they're not as good, but like, you know, I always thought Jennifer 8 was gorgeous.
Yeah,
or even like,
actually, a very quick while we're on Jennifer 8, and there's not too many obvious parallels besides the alcoholism that we've already mentioned, but one thing I thought, you know, this scene essentially like where the two cops go into the apartment building in the dead of night and it's extremely tense.
Yes.
I could see a little bit of that in the scene where they think in Withnail, where they think the poacher is coming from. It's almost, I've seen that in the past and thought it's almost like they're playing like a horror scene. It's funny, but
right.
It is also like, because especially when you don't know, he could potentially be coming for them, you know, and just the sounds, you know, like
there's that like little bit of paranoia, and like sometimes you can kind of work yourself up into being scared,
oh,
you know,
sure.
If you're like, oh, like there could be somebody behind the door, and you're like, oh, and like you kind of know it's maybe not completely serious, but it kind of makes you on edge anyway. I think there's like a little bit of that where they're kind of working themselves up, and
well, and Withnail says that line about those are the sort of windows that faces appear in, and that just that little comment
right.
just makes you as the audience kind of think, okay, what could happen? And I know what's happening, what, you know, on the umpteenth watch, but it's really well done, and that's not something you would normally see again in a comedy, and
right.
and you can see how he applied those skills to Jennifer 8, where it's actually the danger is very real.
Yes. I mean, especially like watching with Neil and I the first time, again, like I remember just not knowing where the film was going, which, you know, is very exciting. Like there's nothing really predictable about it. And even though nothing super outrageous happens, you sort of wonder at the time, like, could this turn into like a little bit of a horror film with the poacher, or like, could it take that turn?
Yeah,
because something about it does feel very unpredictable.
Yeah. That's just got me thinking about, I recommended it to Malcolm Nygaard, who's in charge of a podcast network that some listeners may be aware of. They're called Flying Machine. And I was trying to get him to watch it for quite some time. And he really loves In Bruges.
Right.
And I said that it has a slightly In Bruges-y feel to it in terms of like the melancholy, and also you have, you know, two not very sympathetic on paper characters that you ultimately do feel for. I think that's the similarity there. But you could, if you wanted to, like, well, there's all that business about Withnail messing around with a loaded shotgun. You could easily, if you were Quentin Tarantino, have somebody's head get blown off at that point and then just develop from there.
No, it could take that direction. Or
I'm like, glad it doesn't, don't get me wrong.
I'm very glad it doesn't.
But... but it could, just like, if it did, you know, the stuff that's leading up to that, you wouldn't go, oh, that's a really dramatic right turn, because it could go that way.
It doesn't let you feel completely safe. It doesn't let you settle.
No.
I think that's, you know, part of the appeal of it, of keeping you engaged. It keeps you on your toes. That whole section when they're kind of going off fishing, like, it even reminded me a little bit of it, like Terrence Malick, like in a very sort of roundabout way. But like you said, some of those, you know, very beautiful shots of them in nature, and like there's a little bit of irony also when you watch something like Badlands, specifically when the Martin Sheen and Sissy Spacek characters go off to live in the woods. Like it's a little bit funny when they build a treehouse, and like, you know, it's in some ways reminded me a little bit of that too. So it's I don't know, it's incredible actually, like, you know, what's accomplished with the film. It's not typical in any way.
It's very, as you say, very unique. Although that has, the whole violence thing has got me thinking about, apparently the original ending, I don't know at what point this was changed, but Robinson did have Withnail pouring some wine into the barrel of the shotgun and then drinking it and then killing himself. I'm so glad it doesn't end that way. That too.
Yeah.
So I think that would be awful.
That would have been, I mean, too much.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
That reminds me of, like, I know Kevin Smith said, like, the original ending for Clerks was at the very end of the film. The original ending would have been somebody comes in to mug or to hold up the convenience store, and the main character ends up shot and dead. I was thinking, like, oh, that, like, you know, they're. It might not have that, like, big following if it ended that way. Like, that was probably the right choice to cut that. You know, it makes me think a little bit of that. Like, you could go very, very dark, but, you know, I think it's a more subtle touch the way it ends as is.
Yeah, I think it's better to, I've used the word trajectory before, but to imply the trajectory of the character rather than going, and then he was so depressed he killed himself. The end.
Exactly. Like, it suggests that maybe he won't be around for much longer, but it doesn't come out and, you know, rub your nose at it.
No.
You know,
no.
Like, it's that quality that, you know, makes it more artful. Yeah.
Yeah. Artful is the word that I was looking for. Yeah, not classy, but you know what I mean.
Artful.
Yeah, I was just thinking where I can bring my podcast in slightly. The podcast I present is about Russian movies, and, you know, for whatever reason, at least in Britain, I can't speak for Canada or the US, Russia isn't particularly renowned. You know, humor isn't one of the top things that people would say, which is unfair, because they're very good at dark comedy.
Russian people are very funny. I mean, especially like dark comedy.
It's a survival mechanism a lot of the time. But the film I was going to mention, in terms of not being dark comedy at all and not having really very much of substance underneath but still extremely funny, is Ivan Vasilievich Changes Profession.
Oh,
It's basically a scientist invents a time machine, accidentally goes back to the time of Ivan the Terrible and brings him back to the modern day.
It's also called Back to the Future sometimes, right?
Yeah, just because... Yes, I think that was retroactively added because it was like, we'll get across the fact that it's about time travel. I mean, I guess there's a certain amount of similarity in that it's kind of like bright colours and funny, but it's much more like down-the-line comedy.
Right.
Because there's like a drama element.
I always think, like, the scene with, like, that Ivan the Terrible's looking at the painting of his own future, and, like, that's a pretty, like, heavy moment, I think.
That's that's a good point,
You know, like, it seems like there were more of these in, like, the 70s and 80s, like, that's kind of disappeared a bit now, but, like, when comedies could have just, like, a moment of total, like, seriousness just almost out of nowhere, like, you know, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but, like, I even remember watching... I don't know if you've seen Monster Squad, the kids' film. Like, it's very funny. You know, I love that as a kid. But there's, like, one moment when they're talking to, like, the... They call him Scary German Guy because, like...
Okay.
Scary-looking German guy who's, like, helping them translate the Van Helsing's diary. And they're like, wow, you know, Scary German Guy's awesome. Thanks. You sure know a lot about monsters. And he said, you know, now that you mentioned it, I guess I do. And as they're leaving, like, he just puts his arm on the... door, and you see the tattoos from a concentration camp, and it's like this totally serious moment in the middle of this, like, fun kids monster movie. So I don't know, like, I like moments like that sometimes when they work. They don't always, but it can be a real, like, go for broke kind of a thing, you know, like Whitnell and I, there's a couple of these moments where I just think, like, oh, if this wasn't played right, it would sink the film. You know, like the scene with like Uncle Monty when he's sort of like apologetic almost about, like, oh, I'd never want to come.
Breaking in the middle of the night. Yeah, it's like, fantastic acting.
You know, it's a very, like, serious, you know, there's like humor to it, but it's a very sort of, for that character, a very serious moment. And he plays it that way. Yeah. It like really pulls on your heartstrings. It's not.
Yeah, because, I mean, we haven't, that's one thing I haven't really talked about very much is, again, on paper, that Monty character could just be horrible because, you know, he essentially wants to rape somebody. He says in his very floral way, you know, I'll have you even if it has to be burglary.
Yeah.
It's like, ugh. And you could just then if that was all there was to the character, you could just say, oh, it's a horrible, you know, homophobic stereotype. But there's so much in the performance and just like the little details that, yeah, it's like, yes, he is horrible, but he is also...
Yes.
He's not just a monster. Because people aren't, you know. There's usually some like little sliver of sort of redeeming qualities. And it's, yeah, because Withnail is so nasty to him. I mean, understandably, it's probably very scary to have someone break into where you're staying in the middle of the night. But
I mean, one of the most quoted lines in the film I probably can't say on the podcast for the first purchase.
Yes. Well, I was going to allude to it. It's basically, you know, it's considered to be the rudest word you can say in the English language. And being called that isn't very nice. And he's visibly hurt. And just go, oh, poor Monty.
Well, it seems like, I mean, the way the character's played, it's just like he's been turned down and kind of dissuaded so much. Like, he's just, like, fed up. That's how they have him play it. Which, not saying that's, like, justifying it at all, of course. But, like...
But he makes that very self-pitying comment about being the one... It's not the first time I've had to take the couch.
Exactly. Yeah, it's... You know, that's where that character's coming from.
This is really difficult to talk about sensitively.
Yeah.
I'm gonna crowbar this in.
Okay.
I didn't watch it for a long time, but was aware of it for a long time because part of it, the bit that's supposed to be in Penrith, is actually shot in the town where I grew up. It was. And the part of the country, the UK that I live in, it's close to / being swallowed up by Milton Keynes, which British listeners will go, yeah, that's not a cool place to be from. So I was kind of like grasping hold of this as being like the one cool thing that happened. So I think I possibly avoided the movie for a long time, just you know, in case it wasn't actually that good.
Right.
And even now, I'm like, do I like it just because it's the one cool thing that happened near here?
I think it's okay to like the film. I think
that's, right.
It's perfectly all right.
It's good that people who don't have that reason for being partisan like it as well.
Right. But you had the photographs you recreated of the location, right?
Yeah, it does look pretty... Pretty similar, yeah. The Penrith tea rooms. I don't know what they were at the time, but they are now a pharmacy and have been, you know, the whole of my recollection.
Right.
But it does look surprisingly unchanged. The pub that they go into, they changed the decor probably about five years ago. But I remember going in there. You know, just as I was starting to go to pubs and things, and it basically looked exactly the way it does in Withnail and I, down to like the brass thing on the wall. It doesn't look like that anymore, but it's still basically the same layout, and the front looks the same, although it's not called the King Henry, it's called the Crown. They changed the name, but for the film, I think.
That's cool. So it's always fun kind of recognizing the locations you see in movies, like...
But it is super surreal going, oh, I live there.
Yeah, sure. I mean...
When that one scene comes around.
Toronto's been on film a lot, but, like, usually not as Toronto. It's, like, trying to pass off
doubling
as, like,
for somewhere
New York or generic American city. Or...
Speaking of Jennifer 8, wasn't a lot of that shot in Canada and it's supposed to be California?
Probably. I think like that might be why it looks so gloomy, I think.
Yeah.
I forgot to check. It might be shot in, like, Vancouver, maybe. I'd have to double check.
I saw British Columbia. I want to say British Columbia.
That sounds right. Yeah, because, like, I don't think in California you'd get that kind of constant rain. But...
No. That was one of the, like, suspension of disbelief bits for me. I was like, is it really? Maybe just, yeah, Bruce Robinson likes some rain.
I always wonder, because that film came out just a couple of years before David Fincher 7... And
yeah, I did think, you know, this is not that far behind.
I think it probably, he took a lot from that. It seems like it, because, like, there were other sort of neo-noir crime films, but I always thought, like, I think you're getting this from Jennifer 8, like, that look and feel that, like, heavy rain, just the kind of like dark, the, you know, sort of inky look of it, how shadowy it is. Like, it's hard to pinpoint because there's not like one for one parallels, but something about the look and feel, it seemed like that was maybe the template for it.
Yeah.
In some ways, like the stylistic template.
Well, and also having heavyweight actors in a plot line that could be quite schlocky.
Sure. Absolutely. I mean, sometimes it's handled well, but yeah, that's what I was thinking. Like, Jennifer 8, I think he said he wrote that specifically to be something to appeal to, you know, an American market and make maybe break his way into Hollywood, even though it kind of ended up
didn't work
causing
out.
Him to go into like self-imposed exile, I guess. I don't know if it made any money either, but I think
I don't know,
you know, again, there's like a level of artistry there that I think I've always kind of gravitated towards, you know, and
little bits of attention to detail, like I noticed, like, right at the end, this will probably be a plot spoiler, so if you haven't seen the film, which plenty of people haven't, it sounds like
right,
listen away now or whatever that is, when they're, it's like the last 10 minutes, they're just in this house, and on the wall you see a painting or a reproduction of a painting, and it's Holman Hunt's Light of the World painting, which is Christ at a door about to knock. And one of the like little sub-themes of that film is kind of light and darkness. One of the characters is blind. And it's just like, it's just there for a split second, and if you don't recognize that painting, it's just a painting on the wall.
Yes.
But I went through a bit of a, the Pre-Raphaelites are really cool because I saw a documentary on it that explained why they're not just chocolate box, you know, pretty paintings.
Right.
So I knew, I knew that what that was, and I was just like, that's a lovely little, it's like the journey, like the Journey's End being read in With Nile Night. It's just, that's just there, and if you know what you're looking at, that adds another little layer in there of like, this was put together by somebody who thought something out, rather than this is just like a pretentious book that we, or painting that we've just stuck in. It's like, it's there, but it's there for a reason.
Right, I think like other filmmakers would be tempted to like give you the panning shot across it, so it's like really in your face, and then have another character come in and explain it. And you know, like,
or
he's
other
subtle.
Directors
like,
would I just think, put like the Mona Lisa up there to go, this person is arty,
right? Or not even think about it. You know, like if they do think about it, they have to like rub your face in it. Like Bruce Robinson could be very subtle. You know, that's one thing I appreciate. I figured David Fincher, like aside from maybe borrowing from Jennifer 8. I always think it's weird that like a few of the Whitney Lynn-like actors show up in Alien 3.
Yeah, Ralph Brown's in that, isn't he?
So is Paul McGann.
No way.
And there might have been somebody else. I forget now. Like Richard DeGrant's not in it, but I thought like maybe there was a third one that I can't. I'd have to go and look, but they all look alike with the shaved heads, but or it might not have been from Whitney Lynn. It might have been from like another. Well, Lance Henriksen's in it. He worked with Bruce Robinson in Jennifer 8. You know, so there's like a weird little connection there. I mean, it makes sense Lance Henriksen would be in it because he's returning from Aliens. But it's sort of weird that there's like a Bruce Robinson-David Fincher connection that I always... I'm like, oh, you're swiping from him.
Yes, he's... Yeah.
Bruce Robinson, he might have another film in the works. That's sort of the rumor right now, but... That's kind of a I'll believe it when I see it thing.
I think that's fair.
But as is, like, it's a very strange career, you know, having, you know, Whitney Lynn, How to Get Ahead in Advertising, and Jennifer 8, all pretty close together, and then Rum Diary, and that's it. Like, it's kind of a, you know, sort of imploded career, and it's sort of too bad for somebody who I think is so talented. I'd be curious, like, I think Rum Diary didn't make money at all. But, you know, I'd be curious what his passion project would be right now. You know, I know he writes a lot. Because, like, I think Rum Diary, that was, like, Johnny Depp's passion project. And I think part of the passion project was bringing in Bruce Robinson to direct.
Yeah, I think that sounds like... Yeah.
But, like, I think if somebody gave Bruce Robinson like a pile of money, I'd be curious what he would make with it, because I'd suspect like he's not in that Whitnell and I place anymore, even though that's what people associate him most with. Yeah.
You'd kind of hope not after 30 years. I hope not, yeah. Want to do something different.
Right. But like, you know, some of the films he's written, like he wrote Killing Fields. Like, yeah. You know, he's written stuff that's pretty different. If folks want to hear more of you, what podcast should they check out?
So, they should check out the Roos Files Unite movie podcast, where, as the title suggests, I watch Russian films, but I also watch films which have a Russian connection. So sometimes that will mean, like, it's an adaptation of a Russian story. We did Lady Macbeth, which is...
That was great. That was on my favorite films of the year last year.
Oh, I'm glad. Yeah. Yes, I'm really pushing that one because that is my least listened to episode so far. Oh, no. And it's one of the best films that I think I've covered so far. So that's kind of like an irony there. It really needs to be seen. It's very well done and mostly very dark, but it does have like flashes of, I guess, Robinsonian comedy to it. Yeah. Yeah, I can see a certain like similarity of sensibility there. Well, they're obviously very different.
Was it shot in Scotland or?
No, nearly. It was Northumberland. Yeah, so it's pretty much as far as you can get without being in Scotland.
Right.
Yeah, almost.
It looks like it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we described the scenery as bleak and interesting.
It's definitely bleak and interesting.
Yeah, so listen to the podcast and go and see the film. Although probably see the film first, because it is very spoilery, that episode.
Yeah.
Yes.
Any podcast that the inaugural episode was Stalker, like that's one I definitely want to listen to. And then you covered a bunch of great films already, like To the Stars, The Hard Way, I always think is a lot of fun. That's kind of like a Russian Star Trek.
So bizarre. Strange, with clones.
Yeah.
Yes.
I love all the hand gestures in that movie. The android woman, she's... I don't know. I've been doing them as a joke since I saw it, but
yeah, there were bits that were sort of slightly like Matrix before special effects were nearly that good about that film.
Right.
Yeah, it's a very ambitious film. Yeah, and basically in terms of like the films we cover, I get a different guest each time, so I just try and find something that I think they'd be interested in talking about, or I get suggestions from them. So it's the nice thing about being it's films from a country or connected with a country is you get to do everything. I'm spoiled in that regard. But yes, that's Roos Files Unite if you want to check that out.
Thank you for coming on.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. Oh, before I go, I do need to cram in another Russian thing about Withnail and I. This is apparently in the original script, but it's more like the... I think Robinson wrote like extensive, they're not even stage directions, it's just more like atmosphere notes. It's right at the beginning, and it's something like Dostoevsky says that hell may just be a room with a chair. Well, this is a room and it has several chairs, is the is the description of their flat.
Oh my god, we could go back and talk about it for another hour.
We could. But we'll probably have to say Do svidaniya at this point.
До свидания. We'll be right back.
get lost, director. This sucks that you're trying to make us care now.